The Sunstone Theological Society presents What Does A Course in Miracles Have to Offer Searching Saints? Recorded live at the 1988 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 17th through the 20th, 1988. We take you to the University Park Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
Apparently it's been the custom of the moderator or the chair to mention that though presence in any of these sessions is by pass or ticket, so that if any of you manage to get in without that, please try and make a correction, either now or after the meeting. Yeah. Feel guilty enough to go out and do something about it. This session is What Does A Course in Miracles Have to Offer Searching Saints? When I submitted a proposal, the title at that time was What Does A Course in Miracles Have to Offer Searching Mormons? And somewhere along the line it got changed to Saints, but the more I think about it, the better I like it, because it's kind of nice, if this is true, to know that I can both be a saint and searching. An alternative title to the course, which was brought to my attention the other day, is What Do You Know About A Course in Miracles? Would you like to know more? My name is Tom Davies, and I'm going to be the moderator. The suggestion was made last evening, that we start this session with a song. I know that this is contrary to procedure at Sunstone, because we're all supposed to be tough-minded and objective and all that stuff. But it's pretty hard to deal with A Course in Miracles and be completely that way. And so this song, I think, pretty well depicts what the course is about. It's the song, Let There Be Peace on Earth. And perhaps it will bring us into some sort of a common unity of mind and purpose during this session. So I suspect that most of you are like me and don't know all of the words. And so what we're going to do is Gloria is going to play it. I'm going to read it through. And then if you feel that you'd like to, we'll go through it again and sing it. But I'll make sure I get away from the mic when it comes to that point. Okay. Let there be peace on earth, and let it begin with me. Let there be peace on earth, the peace that was meant to be, with God as our Father. Brothers, all are we. Let me walk with my brother in perfect harmony. Let peace begin with me. Let this be the moment now. With every step I take, let this be my solemn vow, to take each moment and live each moment in peace eternally. Let there be peace on earth, and let it begin with me. So if you'd like, let's go ahead and sing this through together.
There be peace on earth, and let it begin with me. Let there be peace on earth, the peace that was meant to be.
With God and our Father, brothers all are we. Let me walk with my brother. Let it be the moment now.
I had a long introduction here, but I think that that's pretty well introduced everything in terms of what the course is about. And that has been a question that has been asked, what is our purpose for presenting this panel? And I think that pretty well depicts it. So I won't go into some of the things that I was going to say. And in order to leave maximum time for you, the audience, to ask questions, I'll also remind the members of the panel not to take any more time than they have been allotted. Let me introduce now then the members of the panel in the order in which they will make their presentation this morning. First of all, Roger Lewis will speak to us. Roger is a physician in the with a practice in the Provo, Utah area, and he has been a student of A Course in Miracles since about 1980, and faithfully each Wednesday evening conducts a group for the purpose of studying the course there in Provo and the Orem area. Roger will introduce us to the course and as well as give some of his personal impressions regarding its value. Mary Beth Raines will be our second speaker. Mary Beth is on the Board of Trustees at Sunstone and is a well-known family therapist here in the Salt Lake Valley area, has written extensively in many of the Mormon and magazines, periodicals, and has read quite extensively in regarding a number of channeled works, and hopefully her approach will take those works into account, or her presentation will take those works into account. I think, Mary Beth, you've been involved in the course for about a year, is that correct? Off and on. About 2 years. Okay, time flies, doesn't it? Ed Firmage, I'm sure, is well known to many of you. He is a professor of law at the University of Utah and has written extensively, lectured extensively, and is has been involved quite extensively in political and social affairs here in the state of Utah as well as at a national level. And I keep thinking I'm talking to myself. Ed, I think, hopefully will approach approaches the course from an analytical point of view, and also has read extensively in Christian mysticism, and I hope that he'll approach his discussion from that point of view. Gloria Firmage is the wife of Ed and the mother of 8 children, which I suppose should be sufficient, but in addition to that, she's involved quite heavily in religious and social activities here in the Salt Lake area, and puts out a very unique set of greeting cards and other types of cards, which she has both designed and distributes. I'm certain that Ed would take no offense if I mentioned that of the two, she is the better student of the course. Ed and Gloria have been studying the course for several years now. So I just want to remind the members of the panel to take their allotted time, and if they start to go over, I'll make certain that I let them know. Roger?
With that comment, Tom, I'm reminded of that heavy penalties for early withdrawal. Picture some kind of a boxing glove coming out of the sky. My name is Roger Lewis. This sounds like it might be... It's okay. I grew up in Cedar City. I was involved in the Shakespearean Festival right back at its inception. Have been reading and studying the course, as mentioned, since 1980. I'm a card-carrying Mormon. I have been a scoutmaster for the last 8 years and managed to get myself successfully fired from that job only to be rehired as a district commissioner. When I say card-carrying, I pay my tithing and go to church and believe the gospel as it is translated correctly. I think that that is a challenge for all of us. I'm reminded of Dick Cavett, you know, that savant of theology who made the comment when asked what he would do if attacked by a shark. He said he would immediately get himself to the center of a large city. Chesterton made the comment with respect to Christianity that it had been found difficult and left untried. And in my own life, I have found that it is challenging to get from the shark-infested waters to the center of the city, particularly if the center of the city is to be the city of God. And that it's an individual responsibility that bears our full and complete devotion and commitment. A similar pilgrim in the highway of life was a woman named Helen Schuckman, who in the middle of the 1960s was a practicing psychologist at Columbia University's College of Physician and Surgeon, where she was on the Department of Psychology's staff and worked with her boss, William Thetford. The two of them, in discussion one day, decided that life was difficult and that there must be a better way for them to find their course through life. It was only shortly after that that she started to hear voices. She suspected that she was going crazy, literally, and she didn't know what to do. She was at once frightened and mystified by these voices, but in collaboration with her cohort, William Thetford received 1,500 pages from the voice over a period of approximately 10 years, and this material was then published in 1975. It is an inspired work. It is a moving, artistic, beautiful work that was an answer to her question, what is the better way to live? And I personally have found this the most moving and powerful message in my own life over the 8 years that I have been familiar with it, and share it, the message of it, joyously with you, to invite those of you who are interested to a careful inspection of its contents, because the purpose of the course is to bring peace. To bring individual inner peace, profound and meaningful peace into our lives. And what I have personally found is that it works. It doesn't work so resplendently and so swiftly as to do away with the challenges of life. And so I stand before you as one with you who kicks rocks down the highway of life, stubs my toes frequently, and has found great hope in the progress that I have made over the last several years, and the hope that this will continue. To summarize as succinctly as possible, the course is designed to bring inner peace to each of us. And it is also designed to teach us an effective way to forgive. Forgiveness, according to the message of the course, is to let go of the gripes, the grievances, the petty visions, the small wrong-minded way in which we tend to see our lives, our associates, and the world as a whole. I'm reminded of the comment that there is no gravity, the earth sucks. Many of us, starting from that view, find that it's difficult to experience joy. Yesterday, from this very platform, there was articulated a quite pessimistic view of how grungy the world is and how hopeless is the lot of mankind. And I think most of us can easily and readily identify on a personal level that that has been the case. So the course is designed to teach us in a meaningful way how you get from the center of the shark-filled waters to the center of the city. And it does so through a workbook which gives daily lessons to follow, daily meditations. I will read a couple of selected items to give you a flavor of what that would be about. The purpose of the workbook is to train your mind in a systematic way to a different perception of everyone and everything in the world. The exercises are planned to help you generalize the lessons so that you will understand that each of them is equally applicable to everyone and everything you see. Some of the titles of the daily lessons, there are enough lessons for one complete year of study. God's voice speaks to me all through the day. I am sustained by the love of God. Today, my meaningless thoughts are showing me a meaningless world. God is my strength. Vision is His gift. A couple of quotes from the course itself. Right soon after Helen started to hear the voice, this was the message that she received, a message which she received fearfully and with some confusion. It was shared with William Thetford, who recognized it to be inspired. I think some of you will immediately recognize the inspiration of these words. This is a course in miracles. It is a required course. Only the time you take it is voluntary. Free will does not mean that you can establish the curriculum. It means only that you can elect what you want to take at a given time. The course does not aim at teaching the meaning of love, for that is beyond what can be taught. It does aim, however, at removing the blocks to the awareness of love's presence, which is your natural inheritance. The opposite of love is fear, but what is all-encompassing can have no opposite. The course can therefore be summed up very simply in this way. Nothing real can be threatened. Nothing unreal exists. Herein lies the peace of God. The Christ in you is very still. He knows where you are going, and He leads you there in gentleness and blessing all the way. His love for God replaces all the fear you thought you saw within yourself. The sight of Christ is all there is to see. The song of Christ is all there is to hear. The hand of Christ is all there is to hold. There is no journey but to walk with Him. Well, my own... is that the time, Tom? Oh. the first miracle. just a word or two about the concept of forgiveness. Each of us in the lives that we live tend to grab on to suffering, grab on to ideas of how we have been victimized. We grab on to those ideas as the fabled monkey who reaches through the gourd, through this narrow opening into the gourd, to grab on to the desired object, only in this case to find out that the fear that we have grabbed onto holds us captive and does not allow us to be free to choose love. Forgiveness is merely the process of letting go of the fearful image of the world so that we become free for the loving image of the world, because we have to choose. We either see things in a fearful way, and once we grab on to fear, we are captivated and absorbed and controlled by fear. We must let go of the fear to be free to see things lovingly. That is the miracle. When any one of us are successful in accomplishing that, we then share that loving message. And we share that miraculously with anyone else. That's what miracles are. They are practicable kinds of things. If we practice, we get better at it. Some of you already know that. Some of you didn't need a course in miracles to find it out. You've been doing it for years. You will not need the course. You will continue on the course that you're already on without need of the kinds of things that some of us slower students have found help in. The course is not for everyone, but for those two or three or four or a dozen of you in this group that it's for. I hope that my message reaches you in such a way that you hear the invitation and take ample opportunity to study further.
There are five chairs here in front if some of you'd like to come. Also, would you move to the center if there are any seats there in the middle? When I was asked to, I guess I'm a little shorter than Roger, even though I'm tall. There, okay. When I was asked to be on this panel, I explained to Tom that I'm not a ardent devotee of the course, but I have spent the last 3 or 4 years reading all sorts of channeled material, and I'll explain shortly what that means.
If you come down this aisle over here, if you need to, it's a lot easier than trying to fight your way down this side.
And so I would be very interested in talking about the course and channel material on a broader basis, particularly as it applies to use in psychotherapy. As most of you know, I'm a therapist, and I have been interested and intrigued about how these materials, such as the course and other works, interface with the central task of therapy, which is helping a person get in touch with their own inner self as an agent for healing, an agent for change. And so have at times discussed that with other therapists, and in fact have recommended some works. And so from a different view, I would like to speak about that today. There are numerous, maybe even a plethora of books and materials available, particularly in the last few years, that claim to be channeled or received from an otherworldly source. And many of those stories of how that material is received reads much like Joseph Smith's statements about how he received the Book of Mormon. I do not want to equate the two exactly, nor do I want to get into the whole truth issue, other than to say that that is an incredible issue for most people who would consider the course or other materials in terms of what does that all mean. My belief about that in use for ourselves and use in therapy is that the quality of the material is primary and the source is secondary. John Klimo, in a book on channeling, which reviews most of the major books, uses that as one of his major guidelines, that if the material speaks to you, if the logic makes sense, and if the words go to your heart, then in some ways it is true for you. And whether it came from this source or that disembodied entity here or there named something funny that you don't relate with, that doesn't matter. The issue is, does it speak to you? And so I would think in that sense, he has come up with a, you know, kind of a similar test of the Book of Mormon, which is if you try it out and if you read it and if you test it and it works for you, then in fact it is true for you. I would say that the course and a number of these other works do work, and that they do speak truth to many people, and in this way. They are current 20th century, latter 20th century vernacular, speaking to the way we think and the issues we wrestle with today. They also wrestle with many of the contemporary issues that we have. Some of them deal with directly with, like, suicide and AIDS and so on, and others, such as the course, deal with ongoing issues that we've wrestled with centuries, such as forgiveness and atonement and healing in our lives. Before I tell you what my specific thoughts are, the pros and cons for Mormons in psychotherapy and the use of the course, I'd like to give you some context in terms of how I would use it in therapy, because I continue to believe that how we introduce something or how we talk about something is more important than what the content is at times. So let me give you a scenario. Say that I had a client who I thought might benefit from the course, and in fact that happened this last week. There was somebody who I was working with who really struggles with the issue of forgiving himself, and is a very believing Mormon, very much a scripturian. And if I were to introduce the course to him in therapy, what context would I use so that it would in some way match him, but fully honor his own free agency and his own place in the world? I think there are two or three guidelines I should need to follow, and I would think that all of us might use. I think the therapist should not just recommend something that the client, something to the client that reflects the therapist's own growth. And as friends recommending other books, I don't think we should just give out books because it is a place where we are. I don't think there's a lot of damage in that. As a therapist, of course, there's more responsibility. But essentially, I think it's really important for me to match my recommendations to where the client is, to his or her way of being and his or her stage of growth. And that if some people do not click with something, that it doesn't mean that they're wrong or dense in any way. It simply means it does not match their stage of growth. I think also a therapist, and this is my probably my most important point, the therapist should not be slavishly devoted to evangelical use of any kind of materials in order to aid therapeutic development. In other words, any use of materials or any one approach in therapy or any one approach in life, whether it's the course or whatever, should not be the main vehicle. Many times the goals of spiritual growth and healing are confused with the tools by which we use. We think grasping onto the Book of Mormon or some other thing, that is the vehicle of salvation. In fact, we ourselves are the vehicle of our own salvation, and we use these things as tools only. It's really interesting how we can become addicted to spiritual materials and use them to fill up our lives without going deeper to the actual experience of spirituality. And I guess that's my point, is that it's easy to do that. And I think either in the study of the course or in recommending it in therapy, that needs to be an extreme caution. Given those kind of guidelines, I do recommend the course and think it would be helpful in some people's lives. So let me give you my specific statements about what I think is, you know, pros and cons for Mormon peoples. I think there are a couple of ways in which the Course in Miracles would be much at home in Mormon thought or Mormon minds. The basic premises of the course are consonant, in fact, with some mainstream psychotherapy methods. Some of you may know about cognitive therapy, which seeks to have a person look at their patterns of thinking, to look at the patterns of how they construct their reality and then how that view of reality then creates their outer world. And much of the course, particularly the workbook, focuses on that exactly. It gradually seeks to have a person look at how they create their reality and then structure it in a much more positive way to not only match the outer reality, but to positively face life's challenges. I would say that both the course and mainstream cognitive therapy are similar in that they would not erase life challenges in any way. They would not say that they're not real. They would say that they're very real, and that by positively facing them, you stand not only a better outcome, but a better healing. One of the ways to check that out is to go through the first three or four exercises of the workbook, and it's very clear that that's a very gradual, well-designed workbook to restructure a person's way of thinking, and I think it's one of the best I have seen. Also, the basic premise of the course for Mormons would be easy to move into because Christ is the center, and love, forgiveness, and atonement are the changing, healing agents, and that is consonant with the central fiber of most Mormon spiritual belief. For Mormons who have emphasized the justice half of the justice and mercy continuum, the course provides lengthy and intricate explanations for balancing the mercy and the love and the forgiveness and healing part, and I think that helps. Let me just briefly, since I'm out of time, say I think there are two or three ways in which Mormons would have trouble with the course and even some other channel materials, and that is that although let me see if I got the right point here. The unorthodox source of the course may put some Mormons off, but even more so, the language and logic in the text is long and difficult. Some parts read like intricate passages of certain New Testament books. Also, the language and the concepts and how they're labeled are not consonant with Mormon vernacular. That means they're not the same. They're certainly consonant. And so some of the course may be too unwieldy for most Mormons. I think the most salient part would be the daily course of exercises, and to start there. The last thing I have to say is that some of the language, too, may be very authoritarian, and for those Mormons who are moving away from an external authority as a way of defining their reality, the authoritarian language sometimes of the Course may speak in a sense that I have to accept a new way of doing that, even though the Course itself seeks to lead you inward to your own source of healing and your own authority. Thank you.
I hate to see these several lovely, soft, cushy seats going to waste here. There are four of them up here, and I know Jan Bassett would be glad to slide her chair forward a bit so you could sneak through that side aisle if any of you want to come up here and sit down. There's several seats up here. Nice seats. I really am not the skunk at the garden party. I thoroughly enjoy the Course. My wife knows it much better than I. But I have read it and have read commentary on it and have tried to apply it. I think it has enormous strengths. I think the strengths are so completely greater than the possibility of weaknesses in its use that I would too emphasize those central strengths. The Course has not been the way for me into the world of the Course. The way for me turned out to be, through a number of seeming accidents that the Course would say I think rightly weren't, through Thomas Merton, through Francis of Assisi, through the Christian mystical tradition, which I had never been even aware of as a Mormon. On the MX trail years ago, after the first presidency decision here, I didn't spend any more of my time in Utah, but went nationwide with the story of what MX meant to us. On that trail I met many wonderful people of other faiths, as it was largely ecumenical groups that would sponsor those of us, four of us, who were speaking in a nationwide tour. Often it was the Sisters of the Roman Catholic Church, and from several wonderful sisters, particularly Franciscans, though not exclusively, I was introduced to several people, including not only Francis of Assisi but Thomas Merton, who played a very important role for me into, I think, a very similar experience that could be achieved by others through the Course, because it is basically the world of interior Christianity. While all of those Christians were building great big basilicas all over the place, another group of Christians were building castles in their own hearts or discovering them there. And it is this story of meditative Christianity, reflective Christianity, the interior life, silent prayer of listening rather than verbal Santa Claus lists that helped renew me at a terribly important time in my life. So that was my perspective into a world that I see very definitely as simply the Course as being one particular immediate current version of a centuries old story of the interior life and the interior church. That, I believe, to me, is the chief value of the Course. We Mormons particularly have been very effective in making the desert blossom as a rose, in dealing with the external world with great organizational skill, great power, great efficiency. These are good Mormon words, the words to describe a Mormon. Efficient, and so forth. But our hearts may be as arid as that desert. And I don't think we've been particularly good at handling that. In fact, I think we've been particularly poor at handling all that you will hear is likely to be terribly autobiographical. I have been terribly poor in that part of my religion. And so I was a very thirsty soul when I met Thomas Merton. Years later, as I met the Course, I recognized a similar voice. Some may see it unique. I did not, after looking at from the 4th century at least, or really the 1st century of Christianity on, this story. The second, really almost a sub of the first, value of the Course to me is a recognition of the subjectivity of many aspects of the world. Subjective evil. I think if there is any single thing that we could learn to make our world more peaceful today, it would be this lesson. That every fearsome thing we see out there doesn't necessarily have an objective existence.
I'm going to come back and take the opposite point of view too, because I think there can be bad guys out there. I think there is an objective world, and one critique I would make of the Course is that this seems almost to be denied. The ultimate reality of an objective world, of the physical reality of the body. I could see how people, in perversion, I think it fair to say, of the Course, not in application of the Course, could ignore the reality of the physical body, could think that all healing was done mentally or spiritually, that one needn't feed the poor and whatever else in that objective world. I think there are many statements in the Course that could easily be interpreted that way because they are absolute. And I think in their absoluteness they are wrong. I think in their correction they are profoundly true. And I think that is the big value for Mormons, and for that matter for anybody in the West, really. It awakens us to an enormous truth of Eastern Christianity. And I think it's an area from Constantine to the present that we have ignored at great peril, an enormous loss, enormous cost to the Western world, and surely to Mormonism. A Franciscan priest named Richard Rohr, maybe the most listened to Catholic in the world with his tapes, said something that struck me because it was so true to me. In this idea of subjective evil, in talking of the wheat and the tares, and in talking of motes and beams, and our enormous capacity to project the fear and the guilt of our own heart outward upon our mate, outward upon a supposed foreign enemy, and then beat the devil, literally, out of that person outward, our mate, our child, our enemy outward, rather than dealing with the real evil empire, which is always right here. He said, in talking of the wheats and the tares, look at the story. Look at the ending of the story. From my Sunday school class, I would say, in joining with my brother Richard Rohr, I would have thought that when I discovered tares amongst the wheat, I should run out and start tearing out tares right and left with every bit of exuberance that I could bring to the task, and that I could do it. But they're told to leave them together, to let them grow together, because in tearing out the tares, you will destroy the wheat. You will eviscerate yourself as you do your brother, as you try to take the beam out of his eye rather than recognizing the mote in your own. With Rohr, I would see the tares of my youth to be the wheat of my life, and the wheat of my youth to be the tares of my life. I think in the super objective world that Mormons live in, that might be a very common observation. Whether you're dealing with your outward enemy or your inward heart, the idea of destroying the enemy, whoever told us we were to destroy the enemy? What is the footnote for an old law professor? I don't understand the citation of authority for killing the enemy. I don't care whether the enemy is within my heart or my psyche, or the Russians, or whoever you perceive, your mate, a person of a different race or religion. Look how fast in the external world the enemy simply resurrects. It's not only bad, but you can't. You have Germany and Japan being replaced by Russia and China with simply the only difference being a sort of fascinating, maybe meaningful, balancing of Occidental and Oriental enemies that we maintain. And that's all. My time is about up. Let me simply say that I believe as a corrective, as an antithesis rather than simply as a thesis, the Course has great value. The people I see using it most effectively and preaching it most effectively nationally come from profoundly rich traditions, often of Roman Catholicism or of some other tradition. And within that context, in which they do not renounce their Roman Catholicism any more than we would renounce our Mormonism, within that context, it is an enormous enricher. And that is the way I see the Course. Not as another canon of Scripture particularly, though my wife may well disagree. For me, it has always been and will always be the New Testament. To me, there is no competition for that in any other potential canon of Scripture. The words of Jesus Christ himself. Let me, in conclusion, read you a little bit from the Salt Lake Tribune, and you'll see what I mean about interior, about why we must change our mind before we can change our law, before we can change our politics, before we can change our church. We have to change our mind. The downing of the Iranian jet. The account of the downing of the Iranian jet. 200-odd people shot from the skies and killed because they had been perceived as enemies, when in fact they were just people. A military investigation of the shooting down of an Iranian civilian airliner last month found the crew error arising from the psychological stress of being in combat for the first time. They found no malfunction in the sophisticated radar technology aboard the Vincennes, the American naval ship that shot down the Iranian Airbus. The inquiry found that in the stress of battle, radar operators on the Vincennes mistakenly convinced themselves that the aircraft they had spotted taking off from the airport in Bandar, Iran, was hostile and intended to attack the Vincennes. They perceived attack.
This is the end of side one.
What they saw on their radar screens in a way that reinforced this preconceived notion. These misinterpretations were then passed on to Captain Will Rogers III, the ship's commanding officer, and led him to conclude that his ship was in imminent danger. They thereafter killed almost 300 people. Not because of anything in the objective world, but because what they had projected from their own fear, their own guilt, their own trauma, their own stress. Thank you very much.
It's always wonderful to have the last word. And I don't mean that as a corrective to what my husband said, but I would say to you and would bring my statement to you that the Course in Miracles is about changing our mind. It's its purpose. The first, I would like to just share with you a couple ideas that have been meaningful to me. I became involved in reading it about 4 years ago. Picked it up because it said to me 3 days running as I went in the bedroom, it was sitting on the shelf, we'd purchased it in another city some months before, and it simply said, take me down and read me. And so for 3 days running, I got that message and I finally listened and I took it down and I didn't put it back because it struck directly to my heart. And it answered questions that I had been seeking for 2 decades of my life, deeply into scripture study, deeply into prayer, to try and find the deep message of Christ. The initial thing that it established for me was the importance of desire. And I would say that would be the key principle that it reopens for another view, for another evaluation. As it came about with Helen Schuckman and her colleague, asking for a better way, asking for the way of love to be opened. And the way was open to them. And I believe in all of our lives, all we really need is the intention, is the desire for a different way, a desire to seek for God's help. And whatever is the way that is best for us will open up to us. This work is not in place of my Mormon roots or my Mormon beliefs or my Mormon scripture, but an incredible supplement to it that helps me understand in a very personal way my connection with my Father in heaven and the way of Christ, which is within. So it immediately established this link that my Mormonness has always talked about. And I go back to Joseph Smith as the example. Here's this young man, 14 years old, and he goes to this grove and he says, tell me. And he had enough faith to believe that he could be told, that he could be answered. And he was answered. And I would say to you that in all of our lives, and fundamentally in the Course of Miracles, that the question has the answer. There hasn't been a revelation given that has not been preceded by a question, because one is contained in the other. And so I look at Mormonism and I look at every kind of thing that each of us can look at, our personal revelations, and say if we desire personal revelation, we will have personal revelation, because that's what God is about. We are sent here as intelligent beings that are like He is. We are like He is. And as as such, we have the right to the knowledge that is within us that he gave us. And so the first principle opens up this avenue of revelation in an incredible way, and it has spoken to me. The second is how it begins. The Course gives one requirement for beginning on its journey, and that is that we, for just a moment, consider another person's interest equal to our own. So it begins in a context of joining with another person in their inner life, in their inner divinity, of recognizing in them the same value that we have and the same pain. And I come to you today to say that works. And it does begin a journey. The third thing that it opens for me is an absolutely incredible vision of what the whole fall and what the separation was all about. The whole Garden of Eden story is opened up for review and for great magnification, because the Course addresses this directly. It talks about what it refers to as the separation from God, and in separating from God, we separated from each other and perceived ourselves as being individuals apart from him and apart from each other. And we created for ourselves another voice, or our own will, which is our ego voice. And that ego voice is antagonistic to the voice of God, which is our spirit, which always resides within us. And the ego voice doesn't want to hear this. It's always antagonistic to it, because it is the voice of this world. And we could use some Mormon scriptures to describe the natural man, which is always an enemy to God. And the Course is about helping us to understand, to differentiate between those two voices, the voice of our own will and the voice of God. And in so doing, we come to understand what the atonement is. And the atonement is the bringing together under the power of Christ, which is within us, all the love, all the unity, all the joining that was originally there and is projected forever. That voice is not a competing voice. It will not compete with the voices of the world. So the Course suggests ways in which we draw into ourselves for a period of time so that we can begin to listen to that still small voice. Remember in the 88th section of the Doctrine and Covenants scripture that hit me 2 decades ago that said, "Be still and know that I am God." How many times do we find that in the scriptures? This amplifies it by saying the voice of God is in that still place. And if we find that still place within our souls, we begin to hear what it says. The Course amplifies scripture for me. It amplifies the New Testament, the parables, gives me understanding. It takes the 93rd section and makes, instead of a sentence, a book out of the 93rd section, which is about agency and our power to choose. And it addresses, as has been mentioned, the principle of forgiveness as its fundamental principle of healing. And the principle of forgiveness is very different from what we look at in saying that there is nothing to forgive in another person, because what we project in terms of attack and conflict is in fact our own invitation to forget the pain of this world. So the Course in Miracles' purpose is to heal. It is to bring peace. There is no other purpose that it serves. And it itself suggests, if this isn't the way for you, that you forget the Course, that it only invites us to Christ. And so I look at the Course in the context of my Mormon background as another tool, a way. Paul says that all religion, all laws are simply a tutor to bring us to Christ. And I would say that this is fundamentally true for me in the materials that I have read. In a sense, the Course is not a book. It isn't like something you just pick up and say, "Well, I'm going to flip through it today." It is an invitation to experience. And that's where I would end my statement, in simply saying to you that it works. It simply works. When you invite yourself to it, it isn't a reading experience. It begins to open up experiences in your life. And the last sentence that I would give you is that we are all on, you know, as members of the church, our purpose is to bring about Zion and to bring about Christ in the earth. But how many of us individually have that child being born within us that demands to be born. How many of us are nurturing that idea to the point it can grow up and be a reality? For me, this is one tool, in addition to many others that I have, that makes that a possibility, that makes a world of healing for myself individually and healing for the whole world, because the message of the Course is peace. Thank you.
Well, I think they all did a good job, considering the fact that I was passing them these little notes all the time. And so let's give all of them another hand, if you would, please. Now, I think it's important that you have a chance to ask questions. And if you would direct your question, if possible, to one of the members of the panel, we'll pass the mic along, or if they feel that they can't answer it, then they can just pass it on to someone else. And if the member of the panel would repeat the question, please, then we'll all be able to hear it. Yes.
If I understand the question, you were asking if any one of us have had some kind of grandiloquent experience of holiness that was all-consuming, and if so, why we're still kicking rocks down the road? Yeah. Yeah, let me respond to that. The Course has a phenomenon. The terminology in the Course would be a holy instant, an instant of experience in which we are one with the eternal, in which we feel love and security and joy. And I personally have had that experience, and it was like the experience that the main character in C.S. Lewis's Till We Have Faces, where she was given the vision and was able to see fleetingly what eternity was about, and then it went, and she was back kicking rocks down the road. And in my own experience, I returned to that font to sup continuously, and find that I get more and more back to that point. But I still spend a lot of time kicking rocks down the road, and I usually have one or two bruises to remind me of the split vision with which I currently try to see. Instead of having an eye single to the glory of God, I see Babylon, stumble down the streets, looking for Zion, fleetingly find it, back to the streets of Babylon again. That's the way I would respond to your question, and invite all the others to have a go at that.
I've had that experience also in several contexts. I have sometimes in reading the Course, but in many others, in reading scriptures, in prayer, in simply going throughout the day at time to times that happen, I see it as finding a way inward so that we contact that center of our own being and connection to God that creates that wonderment and that transcendent experience. And I think experiencing that, we don't, for me at least, gives any reason for leaving this earth. It's a way of creating more meaning and motivation for staying here and working out whatever we have to work out still. My sense is, I'm reminded of a research that was done about early Mormon women who had had those kinds of experiences in their lives, and as they came back into their lives of, you know, pushing hand carts or whatever else, that it simply didn't change any of the circumstances of their life. What it changed was the meaning and the purpose of their life.
I think the last statement that Mary Beth made is the point, and that is that, yes, I have experienced those peak experiences, and they are simply the most ecstatic feeling of joy that is possible to conceive. And the purpose for me is that it gives vision for the rest of the trip when you're stumbling and when you're in the mud. And it allows me to see that outside of the mud in the next moment, if I can change my perception. And that's what the Course is about, is to change our perception so that we see, instead of the mud, we see the beginning growth of plants. And so it serves as a joyful, peaceful, inner knowing time that leads you through the rest of the journey. I think so. As I understand the question, you're asking about the ego and its role with our own will. And all I can do is maybe give you a metaphor that helps me through that. And that is like an egg that is being, you know, a chicken egg. Let's take a chicken egg. And when it's formed, it's soft in the beginning, but it eventually has to harden to the point that it protects in it. It contains within it all of our life. But at the point of maturity, that chicken has to break its own egg in order to live in another world. And my ego is very much like that. It serves a purpose to get me through a stage of growing in my life. But at a certain stage, if I stay in that same shell of perception, I am dead to anything that is outside. And so this part of my life is an inner journey. And if I'm always living with this hard shell of what I think I am, which is the ego voice, it's simply all of those things rolled up that are my beliefs about myself. And God's voice is standing there saying, look, you're divine. You're not hearing your own real voice. You're hearing all these other false voices. So the ego is the accuser of ourselves, saying that we are only our human aspects and we're not our divine aspects. And that's what the battle is about. It isn't. Yeah. For my mind, it's simply changing the perception of our will. It isn't destroying it, but it's bringing it into subjection to the will of God, to understand that we are one with Him instead of separate from Him. And as our own will, like a germ in our bodies, if it's its own will, very destructive if it's by itself, but bringing into context with God, it becomes a whole and a beautiful will.
Excuse me. First of all, does anybody else want to respond to that question?
I do, briefly. There are, some of you may know that there is a section now of psychology called transpersonal psychology that's interested in the transcendent, transpersonal, peak experiences of mankind in religion and how to integrate that into our lives, either through therapy or just everyday practice. And many therapists have written about this in journals. Should one give up one's ego? Because that's certainly one Eastern thought as well as the thought in The Course in Miracles. And the consensus currently is that one must have an ego to give up first. That if you are a person who has not formed your own life or your own sense of reality, if you have not had an ability to be independent in your own thought and action, you should first move to being able to do that in your life and then move beyond it. You cannot skip that stage of growth.
I think you don't have to take words out of context in the Course on Miracles to reach a very Eastern tradition, if that's the right word, of total obliteration of the ego. And I simply have not found those words repeated many times in the Course, consistent with what I believe to be true. And that is one of the main reasons that I have looked at this as a very valuable antithesis, but not necessarily as a whole in itself. I much prefer, and I'm much more comfortable, it tastes better to me, the words of Jungian thought in dealing with the ego and distinguishing egocentric behavior from simply a powerful feeling of self-worth and being in control. I would read that into the Course, but I would, I think, have to read it into the Course to be able to be at peace with myself on avoiding a sort of self-obliteration. not the necessity of the obliteration of the ego that is very central to the mystical, meditative, contemplative tradition, and to, frankly, I think simply to good psychological growth. But I don't believe that the self is meant to be obliterated in that way. If one wants to look at it that way, one can see an observing self behind the ego, the essence of one's selfness, that is not to be obliterated by any means.
I think she's voicing a question we all are sensitive to, and that is looking at a world of fear. And my only response is that I understand the feeling, the agony of fear. As I project it into other people, and as I see it reflected back to me, and I would simply say that for me, an understanding is growing that when I have peace inside, then I will be able to transfer that out. I will be able to extend that out and see it coming back more. So I'm not just saying the fear is in you. I think it is in our society. And it's part of the image that I was talking about of the ego. It's part of that thing that we need to heal. We need to recognize in all fearful situations a moment of salvation where we can join in, as Jung calls the shadow, you know, the fearful side of us that we've rejected. If we have it join with us and become our power, then we can see that we are really one, and we have a healed society, a healed relationship. So, again, it's finding the inner peace inside, and then knowing that it exists in everyone, someplace.
I just briefly wanted to say, added on to that, you've asked a large question. I think is going to take more than an answer that any one of us could take 2 or 3 minutes at. My impression, and it's just a brief one, is an answer to your question, is that in addition to looking at possibility what fear there is within, I think all of us come to a stage in our life, and I think this indicates a higher spiritual maturity stage, by the way, in which we notice pain or suffering in a certain way, in a real repeated, consistent way in others beyond us. And it not only sometimes is an inner call to answer that somehow, in some ways to be of service to it, but sometimes it's simply that place in life where we can see more suffering than we know we can heal, and that we have to then call beyond, learn how to live with that in a world of suffering or fear that we know that we can't take care of completely. And so it stretches us, I believe, to go beyond the everything can be fixed stage.
Yeah, I'd just like to briefly say it. I believe that. I think that you are in touch with something that is real in the people that you are perceiving. It is also real that they are loving and kind and satisfied and joyous, and they may be blind themselves to those messages, and there is an element in you that can reach that, and you can experience that too. And as you experience that and share it with them, then that becomes a new reality. And as Mary Beth said, that can your hearing the pain now can be an invitation for you to reach higher and feel the joy and share that as a reality.
Just a quick comment. I love the Course in Miracles. It changed my life. And it would be good for me just to know a little bit. I may ask the audience this question. How many here of this group have read the Course in Miracles at least once? Let me just get an idea about where we are. Okay, somehow it'd be good for some of us to get together and kind of do a little ongoing study.
That's my question. This gentleman back there.
I've never heard the course before, but I'm impressed with what I saw here. I need clarification before I can answer my question. Is this a course to be studied individually or in groups?
It goes both ways. It's written, there is no organ... the question is the course to be studied individually or in groups? There is no organized church or official organization that constitutes the Orthodox movement of coursedom. But there are a number of us who are interested in, have found it meaningful in our own lives and are anxious to share it in other contexts, such as group study. And so there are a number of groups around, even here in Utah and Salt Lake and Provo, I know for sure, and other places. And so many people study it primarily on their own, some study it only in groups, and some study it both alone and in groups. Oh, you'd run into all kinds of...
who was the woman that said she's teaching the course in Relief Society? Somebody was at the table. There may be several of them. So it is being taught, but maybe not.
It's like jaywalking. If you ask, you can't.
Miracles, it feels like scripture to me. And so I use it and love it.
put it in the form of a question and answer.
I hear your question. The question is the Course in Miracles an exercise book, a how-to-do-it manual, within the context of Scripture, which is an historical background of the past? I would say no. I think it would be very easy to say yes, because there is a strong element of a course book, how to do it, and I think that's a very strong part of the course. I think the sadness is that we have so largely relegated Scripture to the way you've defined it. I think Scripture is meant to be precisely the same thing. And if we look at the sayings of Jesus as historically interesting, rather than using them precisely as a workbook, then I think the Scriptures have ceased to be very meaningful in our everyday life. So I would say use them both as the workbook rather than one as the matrix within which one can have a far more real workbook. The Sermon on the Mount should be the preeminent workbook.
I think it might be helpful to clarify how this work is organized. There is a text that was the first book that was given, and it's more or less an abstract of all the principles. And it overlays the goal and everything about it as the Scriptures do. And it's about 600 pages. And then there is a workbook that is an exercise for every day. And then there is another book called the manual. And it is more or less a descriptive evaluation of the terms and kind of a digest of the materials that you're going to be dealing with. So it's everything that you're suggesting. It is a workbook to work on personal things. It is an overview, and it is kind of a digest of everything.
I think one of the advantages of the course for Mormons as well as other people of religious backgrounds is that it does not create a new historical context. It does not create a different explanation about reality and what is God and so on. That it is, in that sense, content-less, and it can move within and without any other religious background.
Yes, back then.
The question was, how does the Course define Christ? I think that I have a different interpretation maybe than the Course has, because the Course looks at this life as an illusion. That is our perceptions. There is life, but it is our perception of it that becomes real. And my view of Christ, I have to simply give you my view, because that's all I have, and that is that Christ, first of all, represents the way. When the Scriptures speak of the way, the truth, and the life. And for me, that is fully defined in the Course. It is the way of Christ that exists within me. The light of Christ exists within each of us. And it is that perfecting light that leads us to Him. And so in this way, Christ becomes the very personal guide within me, the voice of guidance within me. At another level, I think in the same way that we project life out of our thought, that life, that Christ was a being that lived in time and space in the same terms that we do. So it is both a manifestation of what Christ's life is about in the life of Jesus, but it is also in the internal way to me to come to Him, and I believe that's the only way. I have a difficult time in understanding the atonement in any other way than that His Spirit is within me and perfecting me as I accept Him within me.
Yes, the Course teaches that God has but one Son, who is Christ, and that we all participate in the Christ as we recognize who we truly are, and that Jesus was the first one to do that and has invited us to join with Him. Well, the question was, The Course claims to be first person Jesus dictating to Helen. Do we believe that, and how do we reconcile that with the Mormon belief that that is a privilege exclusive with the First Presidency? I believe that God speaks to, first of all, I believe that the Course was first person Jesus. And I think that all of us have the same privilege that Joseph Smith did, to go to the Grove of Trees and receive the revelation of who we are and how we can get back to God.
My personal belief is that God speaks to many men and women, all of us potentially, and always has done all through history, and that to view revelation from God as being the monopoly of any group is to trivialize God beyond my comprehension.
I would like to add to that simply that I believe that there are functions that all of us have, and that the church has its function as well. This work speaks to me personally, and I don't know that that's antithetical to believing that the church has a particular function to fulfill and a voice to fill it. So it isn't antithetical to me to believe that I can receive revelation about my own self. I'm not trying to make a church on it, and they aren't either. The Course is not a church. It is not a dogma in any sense. It is a personal journey, and that is not antithetical to me to belong to my church.
I just wanted to briefly say that about that question, I've decided I don't have to decide. That the experience of how that voice of Christ speaks to me is similar enough with what I've identified as the voice of Christ in my life, and so it's a subjective reality. I haven't even really thought much about the external reality.
The question was, is there an official position of the church on the Course? And the answer is, not that I know of. Anybody else know of one?
Don't ask.
The comment was, don't ask. I think if any of us are fleeing, we're fleeing to God.
I would just emphasize that Jerry Jampolsky has written far and away, I think he's, in my mind, the best, most prominent articulator of this, from his own religious tradition without dispensing with it at all. And if you're looking for a popularized but not debased way of looking at much of the Course, I think his writing is very, very good. I agree.
Well, we started late.
I'm
The question is, where are we going with all this? I had two brief impressions, and then we'll pass it on. I think we're going inward. And I think we're going in the direction of tolerating not only more individual difference, but all of our own construction of what God and healing and atonement and forgiving and love is.
I think your presence here today is the strongest indication of where we are going, because we is here.
I think our time is up, and we really appreciate your being here and asking important questions, because that's what made this panel discussion. Let's give another chance.
This is the end of this cassette.